From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. This episode, California's answer to overpopulated prisons, redesign the system.
Punishment may be meted out by a judge, but in the end is actually delivered by the sheriff, who determines whether he has room in his jail or not.
An addiction specialist who says Alcoholics Anonymous just doesn't work.
AA is never wrong, according to AA. If you fail in AA, it's you that's failed.
And Skrillex, the sweetheart of dubstep, who made it big without really trying.
You know, I made that record in my bedroom not really knowing what I was doing. It just kind of came out.
That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. It's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. It's been said you can judge the quality of a civilization by the way they treat their prisoners. If that's true, California in 2011 was in poor condition, at least according to the Supreme Court. They found that overcrowding in California prisons was so bad it constituted cruel and unusual punishment in violation of the Constitution. Paige St. John covers California prisons for the L.A. Times.
Two inmates in a cell built for one. Cases where inmates were housed in the recreation rooms and basketball courts. They were triple bunked. In some cases, mattresses on the floor in single cells.
The Supreme Court found that California prisons were at 150 to 180% capacity. They swiftly ordered the state to cut its prison population by nearly half. California is calling their dramatic prison reduction plan realignment. It's part of a nationwide trend to rework our prison system. And that's our cover story today. California's prison realignment process is attacking the problem on two fronts: shifting responsibility for offenders to local communities and leaving those communities in charge of rehabilitating them. What this means is, if a prisoner is released from a state prison, they are then handed over to local authorities. In California's case, that means county probation. Again, Paige St. John of the LA Times.
The concept of realignment was that if you emptied the prisons, you'd have more state resources, that the state could do more in its own prisons.
Now, offenders who violate the terms of their release don't go back to state prison. Instead, they're left in the hands of local probation officers and local jails.
Yeah, the biggest reduction in the prison population was supposed to come from stopping this revolving door of parole violators returning to prison.
But it's had some unintended consequences. Previously, local probation officers were dealing with minor, low-level offenders. Again, Paige St. John.
Since then, we've seen a dramatic blurring. Some counties have morphed their probation departments into, like, mini parole agencies, arming people with guns, using electronic monitoring and other techniques much more often, and tracking people much more intensively.
It is obviously an enormous undertaking, historic in nature, frankly, this kind of a shift in California.
Linda Penner is the executive officer of California's Board of State and Community Corrections. She's part of the team that orchestrated realignment and a former chief of probation herself. She says this approach works because these populations are well known to the local authorities now responsible for them.
Remember, these offenders came from these counties.
In spite of all the added responsibility, it leaves local communities in charge of their own approach to crime.
It allows counties to remain in their comfort zone, and if they are tough on crime, they can remain tough on crime. They'll just have to foot the bill for it. If they are very liberal in their approach and want to put their money into rehabilitation instead, then they're free to do that too. It's called the eat your own cooking in this sense.
But since local cuisines can vary, this means some inconsistency to how the law is enforced across the state. Something that might get 24 hours in jail in one community might lead to 60 days in another. Margarita Perez is the deputy probation officer for L.A. County. She says that in terms of an approach to crime and rehabilitation, it just makes sense.
At the end of the day, these individuals are all coming back into our communities. You know, John Smith is coming out of state prison. He's going to L.A. County, regardless of whether he's supervised by Deputy Probation Officer Smith or Parole Agent Smith. What's most important is that we have the services to assist these individuals to reintegrate.
This means local communities have to take a hands-on approach to reintegrating those offenders. To get a sense of what that means on the ground, I rode along with a probation officer in Los Angeles County, Whittier, California, to be exact. Beatrice Llamas has been with the Department of Probation for 25 years. She now works in a specific program dedicated to reintegrating the state's realignment offenders.
We can just go ahead and get in the car. Now, there's a cage in there. Is that okay with you guys?
Beatrice and I get in a car and head out. The first two stops give a sense of the diversity of the cases Beatrice handles. The first, Robert Hughes, basically lives on the street. He's clearly living just day to day. He seems happy to see Beatrice. Our next stop takes us to the most beautiful, idyllic suburban neighborhood you can imagine, a luxurious house overlooking the hills. That's where one of her cases lives with his parents. Our third stop falls somewhere in between the first two. It looks like a fine neighborhood to me, but Beatrice points out the gang graffiti and other signs of trouble. We approach one house that's noticeably more run down than the others.
You know, I don't know if you notice the surroundings. There's like a bullet hole in the door, got a window crushed in, you know, signs of activity there. Hey, it's Yamas. Can you come up to the door?
Eric, he asked that we only use his first name, comes to the door. Eric's a heavyset guy with a boyish face. Beatrice talks to him for a few minutes, basic questions about how he's doing.
So how's everything?
Right.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. You still going to the doctor's appointments?
Yeah.
If Beatrice sounds more like a mom than a cop, that's exactly what's going on here. In the couple of months she's been working with him, she's learned a lot about Eric's life. Eric's girlfriend is expecting their first child. That's been a powerful motivator for him to make changes in his behavior.
That baby on the way makes a difference for him in his case. In someone else's case, it may be something else. It may be a job that they barely obtained, and they want to keep that. Maybe school that they just started. It works to all our benefits to talk to them and see what is going on with them.
But being so involved in the lives of individual offenders is also time-consuming. And in big counties like L.A., it also means a lot of strained resources. If Eric were to get into trouble again, he would be referred to a county jail, where a local sheriff would decide whether he stays in jail or is released. Again, Paige St. John of the L.A. Times.
Jails have to become more like prisons now. Jails have people now for decades instead of 6 months. It's resulted in a kind of sentencing reform the state didn't intend, where punishment may be meted out by a judge, but in the end is actually delivered by the sheriff, who determines whether he has room in his jail or not.
Even so, there's still not enough space to hold all the offenders in local jails. Los Angeles County now lets out people who have served only part of their sentence. And even with the shift to local communities, the state is once again having problems with the population.
Well, ironically, the prison population is growing again. The reduction of about 35,000 inmates turned out to be temporary. About a two-year reprieve is what it bought California, and not much more.
Part of the problem is that California is still playing catch-up after years in which rates of incarceration skyrocketed, which brings up an important distinction between two different but deeply related problems: prison overcrowding, exactly what it sounds like, and rates of incarceration, the percentage of Americans who are locked up. Across the country, rates of incarceration increased dramatically over the second half of the 20th century. It peaked in 2008, when 1 in 100 Americans were actually behind bars. I asked Adam Gelb of the Pew Trust how we got there.
There are two factors, and two factors only, that determine the size and cost of a prison system. The first is how many people go in, and the second is how long they stay. And what happened through the 70s and 80s in particular, and much of it in reaction to explosion of drug use, was that legislatures passed and governors enacted and judges enforced and parole boards as well all had a piece in taking more and more people and sending them to prison for offenses that they weren't going to prison for prior to that period, and then also increasing the length of stay. And what states are saying across the board now is that there are much more effective and less expensive ways to deal with a lot of these lower-level offenders.
At the same time, the higher rates of incarceration in America have also corresponded with a historic drop in crime, and in particular, violent crime has gone down. Couldn't that drop in crime be due to all the incarceration?
There's no question that increased incarceration helped bring down the crime rate during the 1990s. No question about it. The research is unequivocal about that. But what it shows is that about 30%, maybe 33-35% at most, of the crime drop was due to increased imprisonment. The rest of it, the remaining 70-75%, was due to other factors outside the prison system. And what the research says is that in a lot of these states, we've hit a point of diminishing returns.
You mentioned other states that have been reducing their prison populations. What are some of these states doing differently from California to do that?
In Texas, the prison population had grown from 50,000 inmates in 1987 to 150,000 inmates 20 years later. And Texas leaders said, we're not just going to continue to build prisons. There's got to be a better way. And so instead of giving the green light to the Department of Corrections there to continue to build, instead we're going to put a fraction of that, about a tenth of that, into expanding treatment programs and probation programs and drug courts and other alternatives for lower-level nonviolent offenders. Policymakers in the states are seeing research about risk assessment, about new technologies like GPS monitoring and drug courts and other strategies that can reduce recidivism and do it at a fraction of the cost of a prison cell.
After my day with Deputy Probation Officer Beatrice Llamas, that human approach seemed to be working. All three of the men we visited are nearing the end of their probation, and she appears genuinely invested in making sure each meet those goals. Reflecting on Eric and his baby, she says,
you know, he's out here, so we got to do the best we could to work with him and keep him remaining free from violating any laws.
There's a tendency to define this kind of work as law enforcement, and there are good reasons Beatrice wears a bulletproof vest and carries pepper spray. But her day-to-day duties look a lot more like social work, getting involved with her cases to help them finding jobs, housing, and leading a clean life. Whether it's California or Texas, a consensus appears to be forming that an integrated approach with more active rehabilitation programs and community involvement is the right way forward in dealing with America's huge prisoner population. Google, Twitter, Facebook, billion-dollar businesses that started out as just geeky ideas born in dorm rooms and run out of garages. Then came the venture capitalists.
Must be Mark.
Hi. We took a look at everything, and congratulations. We're going to start you off with a $500,000 investment.
It looked so easy in The Social Network. A young man with a brilliant idea needs cash. Other men fork it over. Everyone gets rich. But what if you're a woman with a startup idea? A new study says you might not do so well. Fiona Murray is one of the authors.
We certainly know that women entrepreneurs receive less risk capital than their male counterparts. Women-led businesses probably only receive between 5 and 10% of all the venture capital that's allocated to startups in their very earliest and their growth phases.
And so I suppose you could explain that either by saying maybe there's bias, or maybe the pitches from the women are not as good. So it sounds like you sort of set out to peel that apart, right?
That's right. So people have a few explanations for those facts on the ground. So the first explanation is that women are just not asking. So there are not that many women-led businesses that are coming to the venture capital community to really ask for funding and asking for investment. The second explanation that people give is that they come with different sorts of businesses that perhaps don't have the right growth potential. What we wanted to understand is whether or not there were also subconscious biases.
And can you talk about how you went about studying that, how you went about trying to figure out if there's a bias?
Yeah, so what we did is basically take one pitch, so a video of a pitch of a new business to an investment group. All you could see in the video were the slides and the images. And then we took the script of the pitch and we basically recorded that same pitch script with a male voice and a female voice. And we asked male and female respondents to tell us whether they found the pitch convincing, whether they found it investable, and whether they would be likely to invest.
Gender was not the only distinction that you made. There was also, you categorized for attractive people who were pitching.
That's right. So we were most interested in the gender difference and in the male-female difference, but we also wanted to look at whether or not there were differences in the attractiveness of the people pitching. And so what any given person would see is one of four categories, a male or a female voice, and an attractive or a less attractive image of that same gendered person.
So let's talk about the findings, first with gender and then with attractiveness. What did you find out?
So the findings are really perhaps not surprising, but also quite interesting. So we certainly found that there was a quite big gender gap. So we found that individuals, male and female, respond much more positively to pitches with male voices than a pitch with a female voice. So there's a quite strong gender gap in how people find these pitches convincing. And then perhaps the more interesting or controversial finding is we find that there's a very positive, attractive man effect. So people are most likely to find a pitch with a male voice with an image of an attractive man more appealing, more investable than a pitch by a less attractive man or woman. And the group that fares most poorly are actually the attractive women.
Any idea why that would be?
So this is one of the interesting questions in the study, is to really understand where this comes from. I think that certainly with the basic gender difference, we think that this simply confirms what we know from a lot of other areas, which is in places particularly where women are more unusual, where they are the less expected category, then we find that people respond to the more typical individual, the male in this case, in a more positive way. I think the attractiveness piece speaks, I think, to some of the biases that we have in society about what we think people's appropriate roles are. So we think that this has something to do with the gender stereotypes and the attractiveness stereotypes that we have out here in society.
Fiona Murray's latest study is about the gender gap in venture capital funding. Professor Murray, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Again, this is All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. Danish filmmaker Lars von Trier is known for provoking moviegoers. Many were revolted by his film Antichrist, which has been called misogynist and the product of a sick mind. His award winner, Melancholia, presented depression as the only reasonable reaction to the world. And his latest provocation, well, it's right there in the title, Nymphomaniac Volume 1, the first half of a 4-hour opus on sex. And if that's not enough of a warning, if kids are within earshot, you might want to rejoin us in about 3 minutes. Critic Bob Mondello says the film is racy enough in visuals and subject matter that he's glad he's reviewing it on the radio.
When the middle-aged bachelor, played by Stellan Skarsgård, finds Charlotte Gainsbourg's Joe lying battered and bloody in the rain and offers to call her an ambulance, she tells him that what she really wants is a cup of tea. So he takes her to his home, gets her dry and warm, and serves her tea and questions.
Were you robbed?
It's my own fault. Just a bad human being.
I've never met a bad human being.
Well, you have now.
Do you want to talk about it?
Joe doesn't, really, and changes the subject.
Why is that ridiculous fish hook hanging there?
It's a fly. Fly fishing is about tying feathers.
Her host turns out to be full of random factoids on everything from fingernail trimming to music theory. He's also a good listener, so Joe starts to tell him the story of her life. Her sexual life in flashbacks, where she's played by Stacey Martin, and her first conquest at 15 is motorbike mechanic Shia LaBeouf.
If I asked you to take my virginity, would that be a problem?
No, I don't see a problem.
Soon she's telling Skarsgård about a schoolgirl sex club she formed with a friend and about how they went trolling for partners down train corridors.
Can I interrupt here? What you were doing when you walked down that corridor, you were reading the river. Most of the large fish stay sheltered from the current.
If this reaction strikes you as comic, that turns out to be very much the mood that writer-director Lars von Trier is after. To illustrate Joe's tales of 7 to 10 sexual encounters a day, he stages everything from a penis parade to a sequence where his heroine is shagging so many men that she can't keep them all straight and has to roll dice to figure out how to reply when they phone. The fact that she's not getting emotionally involved, of course, doesn't mean they don't, which can get complicated, as when one guy's wife, Uma Thurman, brings her kids over with an ever-so-polite request.
Would it be all right if I show the children the whoring bed?
Let's go see Daddy's favorite place.
Oh, so this is where it all happened.
What this first half of Nymphomaniac ends up being about is emotional intercourse, something the heroine treats lightly until it becomes clear that despite all the physical intimacy, she is irretrievably lonely. I'm hesitant to make too many predictions about where the story's going. Von Trier's movies tend to take a sharp turn at the 2/3 mark, and we're not there yet. But based on the foreplay, I'd say tuning in for Nymphomaniac Volume 2, which arrives next month, is a no-brainer. I'm Bob Mondello.
Director Lars von Trier takes on sex and death in ways that deeply disturb moviegoers. But the business of movie-making itself can be disturbing. The process can be chaotic and even dangerous. Sometimes people die. The most recent case in America was Sarah Jones. Jones was a 27-year-old camera assistant, and a month ago, she died while working on the set of the film Midnight Rider. The film had been shooting at an active train trestle in Doctortown, Georgia, when an oncoming train killed Sarah Jones and injured several others. David Cohen is a senior editor with Variety, and he's been reporting on the case. He says on the day of the accident, the film crew was shooting a dream sequence and had placed a metal frame bed on a train bridge.
And they had been told that there might be a train coming, and if they did hear a train, they would hear a whistle, and they'd have a minute to clear the bridge. And as it happened, for whatever reason, they heard the whistle, and they didn't have a minute to get off the bridge. The train struck the bed, which then became shrapnel. Some of that shrapnel hit members of the crew and broke their bones. One large piece of shrapnel struck Sarah Jones, who was the second camera assistant, and hit her hard enough to knock her into the path of the oncoming train. And she was killed more or less instantly.
We know a point of controversy here is whether the production had permission to shoot on those train tracks. What do we know about that?
We know very little about that, and that is one of the key questions upon which this case will turn when it comes to lawsuits and criminal charges. The railroad has insisted that they did not give permission for them to be on that trestle or those tracks, and says they have an email chain to prove it. The production says that the email chain continues past CSX Railroad's denial and that there was something that seems to imply permission or something like that. Those emails have not been made public.
Can you talk about the reaction you've been hearing from people who work on set since this accident?
There have been fatalities on film sets before, and some relatively recently, but this has hit people in a very different way, and I think for a good reason. Usually when people are killed or badly injured on sets, it tends to be stuntmen who are paid to do dangerous work and go into the work they do knowing the risks that they're taking. But this is a second camera assistant. And as someone explained to me, everybody in the business started on a bottom of the ladder job like second camera assistant. Everybody who works in production, whether it's a cinematographer or a sound mixer or an assistant director, understands how powerless that person is. There is a feeling that in the push to get shots made in an era of a bad economy and limited resources, that productions are pushing harder and harder and that safety is less and less of a consideration. And technicians, camera people, sound people feel across the board that they are being put in danger regularly, and an accident like this isn't shocking for that reason. It's only shocking that it was such a horrible one.
So, David, do you think the death of Sarah Jones is going to have any kind of effect on how movies are made?
Yes, I do think that the death of Sarah Jones will have an effect, if only because it will empower people to stand up for themselves a little bit more. The danger everyone experiences, even very, very experienced crew people on a movie set, is that no one wants to say no because they feel like if you say no, they won't hire you next time. And what we're already hearing is that more people are saying no, and more people are saying, wait, stop, think.
David Cohen is a senior editor with Variety. David, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
The local sheriff's office is still investigating the incident, as is the Federal Occupational Safety and Health Administration. Those investigations are expected to take at least several more weeks. The production of Midnight Rider is on hold indefinitely. This is NPR News. Since its founding in the 1930s, Alcoholics Anonymous has become the go-to treatment program for alcoholism, and it's spawned 12-step programs for every kind of addiction. These recovery groups are part of the fabric of society. They're mandated by courts, prescribed by healthcare professionals, and widely praised by reformed addicts. But not everyone is convinced such programs are effective. That's the idea behind the book, The Sober Truth, debunking the bad science behind 12-step programs and the rehab industry. I asked author Lance Dotis, does AA work?
No. There is a large body of evidence now looking at AA's success rate. And the success rate of AA is between 5 and 10%.
Wow.
Most people don't seem to know that because it's not widely publicized.
And for a baseline, if someone were just trying on their own, what would be the percentages that that would be a success?
Well, actually, it's an interesting question because people stop drinking on their own at about the same rate as they get better in AA. There are some studies that have claimed to show scientifically that AA is useful. These studies are riddled with scientific errors, and they say no more than what we knew to begin with, which is that AA has probably the worst success rate in all of medicine. It's not only that AA has a 5 to 10% success rate. If it was successful and was neutral the rest of the time, we'd say okay. But it's harmful to the 90% who don't do well. And it's harmful for several important reasons. One of them is that everyone believes that AA is the right treatment. AA is never wrong, according to AA. If you fail in AA, it's you that's failed.
And do you hear that from your patients?
Absolutely. People leave feeling much more depressed and discouraged and worse about themselves. Even the tally system that AA uses, where you get a chip for 24 hours of sobriety, it's supposed to work by encouraging you to stay sober because you lose your chip. But the dark side of it is, if you have a beer after 6 months of sobriety, you're back to zero in AA. That makes no sense. It's unscientific. It's simply crazy. If you have only a beer in 6 months, you're doing beautifully.
Now, it's not scientific, but anecdotally, we've heard all of these stories, all these people who say, AA saved my life.
They're not lying, but we have what's called a sampling bias error. We hear from the people who do well. We don't hear from the people who don't do well. All the people, the 90% who go to AA who do not become sober members, don't write books about their experience.
Is there anything positive or any of these 12 steps worthwhile therapeutically?
The reason that the 5 to 10% of people do well in AA actually doesn't have much to do with the 12 steps themselves. It has to do with the camaraderie. It's a supportive organization with people who are, on the whole, kind to you, and it gives you a structure. Some people can make a lot of use of that. And to its credit, AA describes itself as a brotherhood rather than a treatment. So, as you can imagine, a few people, given that kind of setting, are able to change their behavior at least temporarily, maybe permanently. But most people can't deal with their addiction, which is deeply driven by just being in a brotherhood.
There have been other rehabilitation programs that have come up over the decades. How do other rehab systems compare?
Almost all the rehabs in this country are 12-step based, which tells you something right away. It raises the question, what are you getting for your $30,000 to $90,000 a month? And the answer is that they have added on a lot of other, quote, treatments, which have absolutely no scientific basis, like horse therapy, Reiki therapy, which is a mystical idea. Adventure therapy is part of the program. There's ocean therapy, which means you go out on a yacht. None of these things have anything to do with treating addiction, but they're all part of the program, and they develop because since all of these programs are based on the same unsuccessful 12-step model, and they're in competition with each other, they've become like spas. So they try to outdo each other in the extra frills that they put in. And if you don't do well in a rehab, the rehab says, you failed, come back again, and come back again, and again. For the same failed treatment. Whenever we hear about these celebrities who go in and out of the same rehabs, we blame them. We say, what's the matter with them? They're falling out of the treatment. No one says the treatment is no good.
So how do you kick alcoholism?
Well, I've been writing about this for 20 plus years. I'll give you a brief summary. When people are confronted with a feeling of being trapped, of being overwhelmingly helpless, they have to do something. It isn't necessarily the something that actually deals with the problem. They do something. Why addiction, though? Why drink? Well, that's the something that they do. In psychology, we call it a displacement. You could call it a substitute. So what happens is when people can understand their addiction and what drives it, not only are they able to manage it, but they can predict the next time the addictive urge will come up because they know the kind of things that will make them feel overwhelmingly helpless. Given that forewarning, they can manage it much better. But unlike AA, I would never claim that what I've suggested is right for everybody. But I do want to emphasize that, let's say I had nothing better to offer. It wouldn't matter. We still need to change the system as it is because we are harming 90% of the people.
Lance Dodas is a physician and the author of The Sober Truth, debunking the bad science behind 12-step programs and the rehab industry. Dr. Dodas, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Major League Baseball kicked off the season a little early this year with two games in Sydney, Australia, between the Arizona Diamondbacks and the Los Angeles Dodgers. The rest of the regular season opens in a week. Most of the country watched these early games on the MLB network, but here in Los Angeles, you could only watch on a brand new All Dodgers channel. It was the most high-profile moment yet in what's become quite the controversy in baseball and beyond. NPR's Becky Sullivan reports.
It's Saturday night in L.A., and I'm watching the Dodgers here at a bar called The Shortstop. The bar's full, but every few minutes, the bartender has to stop serving drinks so he can answer the phone.
Shortstop, yes, we have the Dodger game on. Anything else?
Turns out, almost everyone is here because, for the first season ever, the Dodgers aren't on free local TV. Instead, they're on a new channel owned by the Dodgers called Sportsnet L.A. And right now, Time Warner is the only major provider in all of Southern California that carries it. Joseph Caldera even had trouble finding a sports bar with the game.
Nobody had it. It's the last minute we remembered here, and we were like, all right, let's get down there, because how else are we going to see it?
It is a huge shock to the system. Just last season, the Dodgers played about 50 games on free over-the-air TV. David Carter is the director of USC's Sports Business Institute. He's been watching this deal since the Dodgers were sold for $2 billion a couple years ago.
One of the big pieces of the sale was that they were going to be able to extract a lot of money from local cable television.
The two channels that aired Dodgers games last season paid just $50 million for those rights. Look at the Yankees. They're due to pull in nearly double that this season. So David Carter says the Dodgers made a deal with the region's biggest TV provider, Time Warner Cable.
The Dodgers would collect a little over $8 billion over 25 years. That money would flow into the team, and then Time Warner Cable would be responsible for gaining subscribers and generating advertising revenue over that time frame.
You heard that right. Time Warner is paying more than $8 billion to broadcast the Dodgers. That is double what even the Yankees are making. But this deal puts Time Warner in a pickle.
They have some financial risk, to say the least.
To make this deal work, Time Warner has to get other TV providers to carry Sportsnet LA. The company won't comment on current negotiations, but they're reportedly asking for between $4 and $5 per subscriber per month. I'll let Dan York of DirecTV put that in context.
Time Warner's proposed price for the Dodgers is over double what the average regional sports network costs in the United States. And virtually every one of those other networks has more than one team.
DirecTV is the number two provider in the LA area. I called them up along with Cox and Verizon, providers number three and four. They all said they were negotiating with Time Warner, but that they hadn't yet reached a deal. In other words, no Dodgers for their subscribers. Andy Albert of Cox says it's not just the Dodgers fans they have to consider.
The cost for just regional sports that we carry today and ESPN is probably pretty close to $20 out of every month what customers pay on their cable bill, and a lot of those aren't sports fans.
Cable bills already average about $100 a month, and as more teams move to their own special networks, a breaking point could be on the horizon. Eventually, people who don't care about sports may decide it just doesn't make sense to keep paying so much.
Yeah!
But that's still in the future. Here, now, back at the Shortstop, Joseph Caldera is just hoping for a smooth resolution.
It's just the business people are going to work it out, and I'm going to get the game soon, but we'll see. If it drags on a few weeks, a month of the season, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm going to be going crazy a little bit.
One game at the bar ain't so bad, he says, but Joseph can't come here for every game. If all these TV companies can't reach a deal, he and all the other Angelinos here at the bar will have to figure out other ways to watch their Dodgers. Becky Sullivan, NPR News.
Here at All Things Considered, we're collecting stories of people making great leaps forward in their careers. We call it My Big Break. For comedian Mike Birbiglia, his stand-up career began at a comedy club when he was in college, except his job wasn't on stage.
I would clean up and sell tickets at the door and run quesadillas to tables and chicken fingers, and sometimes the comedian wouldn't show up, like the opening act wouldn't show up, and they would have me go up. And so I would say to people, hey, I'm Mike Birbiglia, you might recognize me from the door. I might have seated you, I might have put you in your seat, I might have brought you a cocktail. That was me, and here I am, so your expectations must be very low at this point for how this is going to go, and mine are too, you know. And it's always like I was always performing sort of by the seat of my pants. I tried to perform at the comedy clubs, but they didn't want me because I wasn't that good yet. And so I drove my mom's station wagon around the country. Incidentally, I bought my mom's car. I've recently found out that sometimes when people's parents have faith in their child's dreams, they'll just give them the car. But my mom blue booked me on the car. I paid $2,000 for a car with 80,000 miles on it. And I remember just driving around at comedy clubs in Ohio and West Virginia and in Michigan and just all over the place until I sort of got better. And then I eventually was able to perform at clubs in New York. And people always ask me about what was my big break. I think that the most gratifying thing for me was when I was on the Letterman show. I was booked on the Letterman show when I was 24 years old. My brother Joe was there, and I remember we got on the elevators, me and Joe and this producer, and the producer goes, "Do you want us to make a cue card that says the bullet points of your jokes?" And I was like, "Nah, I think it'll be okay." And my brother Joe goes, "Yeah, he wants that." and then I found myself on stage on the show, and I say my first joke, and it goes pretty well. And then my mind goes completely blank, completely blank. I have no idea what I'm going to say next. And I look over, and there's a cue card, and it says Marblevores, which is the name of my next joke. And I said, "The thing about hippos..."
"I didn't even know hippos ate humans. I just thought they ate those little white marbles. I thought that was the point of Hungry Hungry Hippo. That hippos are marble boars."
My parents really didn't want me to be a comedian, and they thought I was going to be a complete failure. And when they saw me on the Letterman show, I think they thought, "Oh, I guess other people think he's okay at this." I honestly think that for a lot of people, that is one's big break in life, when you can, in one lucid moment, explain to your parents what the heck it is you're doing and have them sort of nod in understanding just slightly enough that you feel a moment of gratification, and then it's gone, and then they're like, "What is it that you do?" You know, and then they're back to the not understanding it at all. But I think in some way, sort of like a doctor's note to my parents saying, you know, it's okay if Mike continues to be a comedian.
That's Mike Birbiglia. He's on his 100-city tour called Thank God for Jokes. He'll be in Atlanta and Charleston next week. We want to hear about your big break. Send an email with your story to mybigbreak, all one word, at npr.org. Once again, you're listening to All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. America's own John Adams has been called one of the world's greatest living composers. From his Pulitzer Prize-winning lament for the dead of 9/11, called On the Transmigration of Souls, to the triumph of his opera Nixon in China, John Adams has tested his boundaries, and our own, time and again. The LA Philharmonic just released the first ever recording of John Adams' latest oratorio, The Gospel According to the Other Mary.
"Now before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour was come..."
The libretto in this work is made up entirely of existing texts, in this case passages from the New Testament. But Adams and his librettist, Peter Sellars, also chose modern text to supplement the stories of the Passion of Jesus and the resurrection of Lazarus. It's a device they also used 14 years ago on a companion piece, the story of Jesus' birth, they titled El Niño.
Peter Sellars and I chose texts that were largely by women. I figured that women probably knew something about giving birth. So when it came to telling the other end of the tale, the arrest and crucifixion of Jesus, we took pretty much the same tack. We used the biblical narrative, but we interwove it with contemporary texts, including Dorothy Day, the Catholic social activist, and Rosario Castellanos, the great Mexican poet, Primo Levi, and several others as well.
And you start with great intensity with this text from Dorothy Day, which describes a scene in a prison.
This is a passion oratorio that starts not with a gloomy, lugubrious chorus, but with a woman locked in a prison cell next to another woman who's withdrawing from heroin addiction. So it starts, as they say in media res, really at extremely intense level and barely lets up for the next 2 hours.
What is the perspective on the life of Jesus that you're trying to explore? Who is the other Mary?
Well, the other Mary, of course, is Mary Magdalene, about whom there's enormous mystery and various interpretations. And I don't really care about whether there was a historical person or not. I mean, for me, all of these characters are what I call mythic archetypes. To me, she's a damaged woman, a woman who may have had a very brutal past. She may have been abused as a child. She certainly was abused by men. Possibly she had to indulge in prostitution to support herself, and she's found in Jesus, hope and spiritual salvation. But she's frustrated because she also loves him carnally, as they used to say, and can't get what she needs from him on that level. What did very much please me was the way that we treated Jesus, because there is no person who plays the role of Jesus. There's no Mel Gibson. There's no Victor Mature or Burt Lancaster. Actually, everyone in the cast quotes Jesus at one time or another. The tenor, our wonderful Russell Thomas, who also does play the role of Lazarus, will be Jesus for a moment. And then even Mary Magdalene will be Jesus for a moment, or the chorus will be Jesus, or the countertenors. And so you don't actually have him there. He's just there as a kind of luminous presence. But to me, that's very, very eloquent, because I feel that, for me, Jesus is more an embodiment, a spirit, than an actual living flesh and blood person.
Jesus said, "Take you away the stone. Take you away the stone. Take you away."
My guest is composer John Adams, and we're talking about his new work, The Gospel According to the Other Mary. You have dealt with spiritual themes before, but there's something about this work in particular that I've thought of you as an irreverent composer at times, but this is not an irreverent work. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yes, I do know what you mean. This is, I would say, the most gravitas of any piece of mine, including Dr. Atomic, which, is about the atomic bomb, or The Death of Klinghoffer, which is about terrorism, both very dark and somber topics. However, with that said, what I love about this Other Mary is that despite the wrenching scenes of Lazarus' death and the execution of Jesus and, the grief of the women who loved him, there are these moments in it of just sublime grace, where the chorus just comes in and, the first time it does it, it sings a song, En un día de amor, a little Spanish song by Rosario Castellanos, which is just purely full of life and sensuality and even eroticism, which I said in the original Spanish.
What's also fascinating here, you really bear down on where the mysticism intersects with the political in Jesus.
Well, of course, Jesus was provocative. He spoke on behalf of the powerless. And, the great irony of my composing this was that I composed it during the period leading up to the last presidential campaign. So I listened to, all the right-wing you know, blowhards talking about how the poor are just, you know, freeloading and they're, you know, taking food stamps and not working as they properly should, and maybe we should take their food stamps away from them and take their welfare away from them, and, you know, that'll prod them to get up off their behinds and find a job. And so I realized that things are really no different today than they were in the time of Pontius Pilate.
Each of us has been a slave in Egypt, has sought straw and clay with sweat.
It actually makes me think of a passage from the Gospel of Matthew, the part about the final judgment where Jesus talks about the dispossessed, you know, the hungry, the stranger, the prisoner, that when you mistreat them, you mistreat me.
Well, I think really, in a sense, that's the essence of this oratorio. And I think it's also, for me, of course, the issue of rebirth, because I do actually set the crucifixion and Jesus' death and his resurrection. I couldn't believe that I was doing it. You know, I'm not a particularly religious person, and I had not given a great deal of thought to that since my childhood. And yet here I was sitting in my studio in Berkeley, California, addressing, you know, the symbol, probably the all-time critical symbol in the Western world, and trying to find a musical utterance for it.
That's composer John Adams. His most recent dramatic work is The Gospel According to the Other Mary. The recordings with the Los Angeles Philharmonic have just been released. John Adams, real pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
It's been a terrific pleasure. Thank you, Arun.
It's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. Hari Kondabolu is an Indian-American comedian. You might have seen his Konda bulletins on the FXX show Totally Biased. He's just released a new album, and the cover art is an instant classic, a picture of Hari proudly perched on a rickshaw that's being pulled by a white guy in a suit. Yesterday, Hari came by our New York bureau, and I asked him to explain that cover and the title of the album, Waiting for 2042.
That's the year when white people will be the minority, so I wanted to be provocative, so that was the first inspiration for a cover like that. The second inspiration is I was at the South by Southwest Festival a couple of years ago, and I noticed that there was a lot of rickshaws, and a lot of them were pulled by, like, white dudes. And they didn't call them bicycle rickshaws. They called them pedicabs. It's the same concept, and it was familiar to me because I'm like, I remember riding in them as a kid when I'd visit my grandmother in India. I remember getting into the back of this bicycle rickshaw being pulled around by this white dude and just being stunned, like, oh, my God, I think I made it. I don't think my grandmother in India would believe this is happening right now.
She'd be so happy.
Right. This is colonial justice.
So the setup to that bit about 2042, you talk about how you get accused of being obsessed with race. I got to say, there is a ton of material on this album about race.
Yes.
Are you obsessed?
I mean, I don't think I'm obsessed with race. I mean, it's part of my lived experience and my day-to-day and the history of this country. Certainly when I look at things, I see things in terms of a racial angle. I spot things maybe faster than other people because I pay close attention to it. You know, it's not like everything has to do with racism on, you know, every level. But at the same time, when so much of this country is built on, you know, where are all the indigenous people? Where are all the different First Nations? Like, there is something racialized to the foundation of this country. So you can't help. Well, I can't help but notice those things. You know, and I say it on the album, saying I'm obsessed with racism in America is like saying I'm obsessed with swimming when I'm drowning. This is my way of staying afloat, is to talk about the things that bother me, that hurt me, and trying to find something funny out of it.
One of the bits that I think is my favorite on the album, and this picks up on the theme of tolerance, you take on a Matthew McConaughey interview with the gay rights magazine, The Advocate. It's basically you just breaking down this interview, and yeah. It's hilarious. You go on for several minutes, but how did that work? When you read that piece, did you think, this is a bit right now? Or did it have to kind of percolate for a while?
Oh, I mean, Matthew McConaughey kind of did most of the writing for me, to be honest in that. I mean, he's very well-intentioned, and I think that is a fair thing to say about Matthew McConaughey. During the course of this interview, he wants to support the gay rights community, but he's somebody he went to school with at the University of Texas, Austin. He kind of outs them by accident.
Well, you mentioned that this was an Indian student, and by outing him, that pretty much anybody who knew the one Indian student there at that time.
Yeah, would know, like, oh, that must be Prakash. And so it's very strange just that he has an anti-bullying program where his idea is to get the kids who are bullied to play sports with the kids who might be bullying them in some kind of weird school-mandated violence. Like, all these things that are so well-intentioned, and he means well by it, but he's not qualified to do this. And the end of the joke is basically, you know, Matthew McConaughey is the Lenny of Mice and Men of the gay rights movement. Like, he didn't mean to kill anybody. He just wanted to give people a hug, and he did it too hard.
You know, with everything on the internet these days, it feels like every comedian has a podcast. I don't remember the last time I sat down like this and actually listened to a comedy album. What does it mean now, having a comedy album out in 2014?
It's, you know, it's funny. It surprises people. People are kind of shocked by, like, the questions they ask me are, is it available on Spotify? People ask me, why isn't it a visual thing? Why didn't you make a video? And I don't think that's important. I think some of the best comedy I ever heard was just audio. Like, mm-hmm. Dave Chappelle's album, I didn't know it was a Showtime special. I just thought it was the audio. And he was so funny just hearing it, hearing this burnt thing somebody had given me. Sorry, Dave. It was unbelievable. Like, the imagery and how he described things, it was so vivid. So when I actually saw the special, I kind of felt disappointed. Like, I didn't live up to the thing I imagined. And so, you know, to me, audio is still an incredible thing. And to captivate people for an hour with just words, I think, is amazing. And I'm not just saying that to pander to the NPR audience.
I was going
to
say, obviously, we agree that
radio is powerful. And that just listening is powerful.
Hari Kondabolu's new album, Waiting for 2042, is out now, and he's on tour. Hari, thanks, Yar.
Thank you so much, Arun.
It's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. Okay, everybody, buckle your seatbelts, and if you're listening on a stereo with a good subwoofer, make sure you secure the fine china. This is Skrillex. He is huge right now. If you don't know him, you're probably not a millennial. Go look at the cover of this month's Rolling Stone. He's the biggest name in a genre called dubstep. He's got 6 Grammys, over 600 million views on YouTube, and this double platinum single called Scary Monsters and Nice Sprites. His real name is Sonny Moore, and he's just released a surprise album called Recess. Yesterday, he stopped by our studio in Southern California to chat with me about it. Now, I know not all of you are millennials, so I wanted to start with the basics of dubstep. So I asked Sonny to explain what's called the drop.
There's always some sort of, you know, build up, you know, and always some sort of, like, moment where even in techno, where it's really simple, it will be the same loop over and over again, but the drop comes, and quote-unquote drop, and that's usually when the kick drum comes in or something.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you listen to funk and disco, drum beat comes in, poof, and all of a sudden the bass line comes in.
Yeah.
That's kind of like, it's sort of like that's, it's the same, it's a similar dynamic sort of way of approaching how to write music, but, you know, taken in so many different ways. I'ma try it out. Okay.
So this new album, and for people who don't know much about the history of electronic dance music or EDM, in some ways, it's almost like a primer. There's guides through some of the sounds we've heard from the past. Let's talk about this track, Ragabomb. What's the style we're hearing there?
Well, I guess it's, you know, the Ragga Twins are sort of like really legendary MCs from London that came out of like the jungle and drum and bass scene. So I feel like there's a lot of elements of jungle and drum and bass, but it's got the halftime beat for the most part. So drum and bass and jungle's generally around, you know, 170 to 175 BPMs with...
Beats per minute
with, like, a double-time snare. Right, and, like, all we did with that is just took the snare and made it halftime. So it's... But that's just kind of like... I just wanted to make one song that was just really noisy and like louder than anything else I've ever made.
Mm-hmm.
Just for the fun
That's
of
something.
It. Yeah, I don't know.
You're somebody that, you know, a lot of people like to talk about, like to define you, right?
Right.
I mean, like to define your music and where you are in electronic dance music. Is it dance music or
right,
isn't?
Right, right.
And there's this controversy over you've been called bro step.
Yeah.
And that was originally an insult, right?
Yeah, it was originally an insult. And
what's it supposed to mean?
I guess it was the whole idea is like girls didn't like my music, which was really funny and opposite because we, you know, I think, and this is no offense to anyone making dubstep because I was going to those shows when there was only 100 dudes at the Echo. But now I feel like, you know, the progression of just electronic music in general, like a lot more girls listen to bass music now. Like girls weren't listening to that type of stuff. It was a derogatory term in like the forums for all like the heads, like mm-hmm. the purest dubstep heads that weren't into anything that had it, too much mid-range sound in it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But then also, I feel like it might have been Rolling Stone or Spin who like gave Bangarang a review, and it was actually a good review. It was a positive review, but they called it brostep. And then from there, some people took it as it's a legit thing, and it's not a negative thing. So it's just a really funny word that has this polar opposite meanings for different types of people.
Well, you've embraced it in that way. You have a track on here called All Is Fair in Love and Brostep.
Yeah.
Should we hear a little bit of that?
Yet 1,000 miles from the Earth, a rocket would need this much power.
It's fun watching you listen to your own music. You can't sit still.
Sorry.
That's all right.
Just vibing. No, but no, it's just cool to hear them in these headphones because they sound really good. I need to get a pair.
So that's your answer to the bro step.
Well, I guess like if people are calling it over the top and it's crazy and like, I guess then all is fair, right? You know, that's the point.
I'm curious about the collaboration process when you work with other artists, because I have this thing in my mind imagining you working by yourself, like in a studio with like a bank of computers, and it's just you doing your thing. How do you integrate your style and work with other people?
Well, the thing is, like, I'm finishing everything and mixing it and mastering myself, so that's when like the personal part comes. But I'm, you know, I come from singing and playing guitar and instruments, so I love, you know, collaborating, like, right there in the moment is where the magic happens. Some people like to just get a vocal and then do it all in post, but I'm really involved with the artist. And, you know, like, for instance, when I did the record with Chance the Rapper, Coast is Clear.
Yeah.
You know, I recorded his whole band, so it's, like, live horns and keyboard solos and all that stuff were performed, and we did that all in one day. We just wrote the song. I wrote some chord progressions out, had them replay it, reinterpret it. You know, Chance just started like toasting all over it, and just like, you know, it happened really quickly in the sort of whim of the moment. The group process is like half the fun, I think.
I think the coast is clear, let's go. Leave our coats and beers, let's go. Leave your girlfriends here, let's go. Leave your hopes and fears, let's go. What you scared for? Let go, let go, let go, let go. What's your interest? Who you be with? Can I ask a question? Can you keep a secret? I don't really give a what. What I need to know is,
in your music, you know, there's so much texture, so much fine detail, so many layers. When you're working on this, putting it together in those final stages of the album, do you just agonize over it? How do you know when you're done?
See, that's like the one curse. I feel like anybody that's just mixing and mastering alone, when I was in a band, it was like you'd write the songs, your producer would record it, and that was it. And it can be agonizing. Like the thing about when you're mixing too, and it's all in the box and in the same place where you've made the records, it's easy to start changing stuff last minute, you know? So it's all about just committing to whatever you have and there's some songs that took me so long to mix, like over and over again that like...
Which ones?
You know, All Is Fair took me a long time. It's just so loud, but it still has dynamic, but I just wanted to be... I needed that sort of energy and power, no pun intended, because those are the lyrics. And the key is low, the key is in E, and that can be difficult with bass and low end.
Mm-hmm.
And then something like Coast is Clear happened so quickly. Stranger happened really fast, too.
So somebody said, I don't remember who it was, somebody once said, a work of art is never completed, only abandoned.
It's a perfect way. I definitely abandoned this record, man. I was like, I mean, I remember, like, the turn in day. Like, I turned it in the hour of, like, the next morning, stayed up all night. I was in New York, like, going right back to the studio after the show. And it did feel like I just abandoned the record. Like, take it. I don't care anymore. Like, I hate this thing. No, it wasn't, like, totally like that. But I totally get that feeling.
That's Sonny John Moore, a.k.a. Skrillex. His new album called Recess is out now. Thank you so much. It was a blast speaking with you.
That was it?
Yeah.
Okay.
For the week ending March 23rd, 2014, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, Becky Sullivan, Daniel Hajek, Linya Anwar, and Francesca Fenzi. Our intern is Stephen Jackson. Patrick Murray is technical director with technical support from Marcia Caldwell and Leo DeLacula. Muthoni Muturi is our senior editor, and Phil Harrell is standing in for Steve Lichtai as senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. We'll be back next week, and remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station.